So we are back in Mark's Gospel today, and if you've got a Bible, if you want to turn to Mark chapter 9, and we're looking at verses 14 to 29. Now, just before we kind of we read this, I want to point out this is the last of four instances in Mark's Gospel where Jesus confronts dark demonic powers. And it would be easy to read this and think that this is like a textbook for dealing with situations of deliverance. But actually, there are a few features of this story that make it quite unusual, that make it unusual in the way that Jesus deals with these dark powers. And I think you'll see that as we go through it, this story is less about Jesus dismantling darkness and more about Jesus dismantling doubt. So, Mark chapter 9, verse 14. And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed. They were literally in wonderment and ran up to him and greeted him. And they asked him, he asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" And someone from the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And he answered them, "Oh, faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him. And when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood, and it has often cast him into the fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible for the one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out, "I believe, help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered into the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer." This is the word of the Lord. I crave certainty. I long for certainty. I love certainty. In decision making, I love to have like worked out all the permutations so that I am as certain as possible that I have certainty in this circumstance. But I'm sure you've spotted a flaw in this. Certainty is quite rare in this world. Certainty is quite elusive, and it's almost like trying to nail jelly to the wall. You know, we live in a world that is very nuanced. It's not black and white. It's complicated. And I think what creeps in then where there's a lack of certainty is doubt. And along with doubt comes fear and sadness. And I think if we're honest, if we're followers of Jesus, if we're Christians, whenever we experience doubt, we often get a little bit of guilt that creeps in as well. Because we feel like, should I have these questions? You know, should I have these doubts? But the thing is, you know, as we look at this passage, we see that not all doubt is equal. Not all doubt leads to sin. That actually doubt can either lead us further away, or it can lead us closer to. And in this passage, there are kind of three little snapshots of doubt that we see, three ways to deal with doubt. And in these different kinds of doubt, the answer to all of these is guess what? Jesus, if we will let him. Now, just before we dive into these snapshots, I want to look at the kind of context of what's happening here. Now, we started the story in quite an in-between place, didn't we? We kind of dived into the middle of something that was going on. And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. Well, who are they and where are they coming from? Well, if you were here 2 weeks ago, you'll remember that Peter, James, and John are they. And they were up a mountain. They were up a mountain with Jesus. And Jesus had taken these three away for like a special moment. And he'd left the other nine disciples down at the bottom of the hill. It's a little bit like, you know, when a teacher leaves a class. And if you are a teacher and you've ever left a class, you'll know what's coming. And so Jesus goes up the mountain with these three disciples, and he unveils his full glory. He shows them, this is who I am. He showed them the glory that he had with the Father before the foundation of the world, and the glory that he would once again have after his resurrection, and that he would reveal at his second coming. And so they now come down the mountain after this experience. And immediately, all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed, and ran up to him and greeted him. And we don't know why they were greatly amazed. Why were they in wonderment? You know, is it because Jesus' face was still glowing from what happened at the top of the mountain? We don't know, because it doesn't tell us. Maybe they were just relieved. It's almost like, you know, when the teacher leaves the class and the good kids in the class are like terrified at the chaos that's going to kick off, and the teacher walks back in and there's just a sense of relief, you know? Oh, actually, here's somebody who knows what they're doing, and thank goodness they're back. And so maybe it's just that. But the thing is, there's this argument going on. There's a dust-up going on between the disciples and the scribes. Now, the scribes we've seen already through Mark's gospel are these experts in the law, the experts in religious law. And they've come everywhere Jesus goes. They kind of follow him because they're not looking to learn from him. They're looking to pick holes. They're looking to critique. These are scribes that are doubting. Now, the question, what are you arguing about with them? We're not told what the argument was, but I think we can pretty much have a good guess at what was going on. Because the disciples are here, the father pops out of the crowd and he says, "Teacher, I brought my son to you because he's afflicted, he's demonized, and I asked your disciples to cast it out and they couldn't." And so clearly that's the source of the argument. And you can imagine the argument going something like this. "You can't cast out this demon, therefore your rabbi is a fake." Now, I guess they're kind of missing the point here, that actually they couldn't cast it out either, but they've kind of chosen to ignore that, you know? And so they're using this as another means to kind of reinforce what they already believe about Jesus. Now, they've got what we would call these days a confirmation bias. They've already decided what they believe about Jesus. You know, just like this dude has already decided what he believes about the woman in the pen. You know, it makes no difference what you say. You've already decided I'm guilty. Gasp, the witch can read minds. You know, they've already made up their minds about who Jesus is. You know, a couple of chapters earlier, Jesus had delivered somebody from a demon. And they said, "It is by the power of devils that you cast out devils." You know, we recognize that you got power, but we're not going to say that you're king. And the thing is, this is such a dangerous place to be. The religious leaders, the scribes, have gone from this place of like having questions over who Jesus is to a place of cynical unbelief. They've decided that this is who Jesus is. He is not our king. He is not our Messiah, and it doesn't matter what he does from this point on. We are just going to confirm what we already believe about him. And it is such a dangerous place to be. Because this for them, is about it's a question of rulership. Yeah? If God has become human here, and if this is Messiah, and if what he's been teaching us about the kingdom is true, then actually that demands something of us. We've either got to say that he is king or he's not. And the same question gets thrown at us. If God really did become human, and if he did suffer many things, be rejected, be killed, be raised again on the third day, and now is seated at the right hand of God, if that's all true, then that demands a response of us. And you find that often, like, I remember we did a Christianity Explored course with somebody many, many, many years ago and came to the kind of crux point of it. You know, so what do you think of Jesus? Well, yeah, I believe he's God. I believe he is who he says he is. So what are you going to do about it? Well, I don't want to follow him because I'd have to submit to him. Like, that grieves me. And it still grieves me because that person is still in the same place today. Such a dangerous place to be. And I want to be clear here that this isn't the same as... So the scribes, they're not doubting because they've got intellectual doubts. Now, intellectual doubts is another thing altogether. You know this thing of, I want to believe, but I've got these questions. That's a different place altogether. You know, questions like, is it really possible for a virgin to give birth? Is it really possible for God to become human, to be killed and to rise from the dead? Why are there so many denominations? Why is there so much suffering in the world? And do I have to believe in Noah and a big boat and the flood? And science and faith, they don't get on very well, do they? And then the Bible, like, can I really believe that this is the word of God? You know, these kind of questions, ask them. You know, if you got these questions, ask them, because there are answers. Now, it might not be that you get full answers to those questions. It might be that you land up with a sort of, you know, this is half satisfying, but is it enough for you to say, yes, I believe he's king and I'm going to give my faith to him? Because there's this beautiful moment where Jesus heals a guy that's blind in John's gospel. And this guy then gets hauled up before the religious leaders and they're kind of drilling him and they've got the spot lamps on him and they're saying, what do you think about him? Do you think that he's Messiah? And he's like, I don't know. But one thing I do know is I was blind and now I see. And that was enough for that guy. And so you may never get full answers to all your questions, but you just want to get to the point of saying, yeah, I know enough. I know enough to hand my life over to him. And so if you've got those questions, ask them. Don't allow them to become that place of cynical unbelief. Come to him. He's big enough to answer your questions. And actually, like, come to me with your questions. I am not promising I've got answers to them all right? I might have responses. I might not have answers. And actually, if I don't have answers, we can look at them together. You know, we can work out these things together, but ask the questions. Don't sit in a place of doubt. So then you've got the disciples. Now, this is a different kind of doubt altogether here. The teacher, the dad, brings this child and he says, teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out and they were not able. Now, guys, this is bizarre, right? If you've been tracking with what's going on in Mark, just a few chapters earlier, Jesus sent these guys out on mission. He sent them out in the authority of his name, with his power, and they proclaimed the good news and they healed the sick and they cast out demons. That's what they did. And they did it with many people. And the other Gospels tell us that they came back from their mission trips and they were like super excited because they'd heal the sick and they'd cast out demons. And yet, here they are in a situation where they can't cast out this demon. And Jesus responds to them, oh, faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? And I think this response from Jesus kind of undercuts a little bit the sort of surfer dude image of Jesus that we sometimes have, where, you know, he's just cool with everything, isn't he? You know, he's kind of chill. Actually, he's not, because faith really matters here. And when he says, oh, faithless generation, it means unbelieving. And faith matters here, because faith is how we engage with the activity of heaven. It's how we engage with what God is doing in the world. And the question is, like, this sharp rebuke, who is it issued to? Like, there's three groups of people here. And, like, it could be to all of them, but it is definitely to the disciples at this point. Jesus is definitely directing it to them. And, you know, he says, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? And yet the beautiful thing is that he doesn't cut the disciples off at this point. And he's like, right, I'm done. I'm binning you lot off. I'm going to go and find myself some more disciples. Like, he bears with them. He carries on teaching them because this is who he is. But we come to this question, and it's a really significant question. Right at the end of the story, we saw how they went into a house with Jesus and they asked Jesus the question, why could we not cast it out? Now, Jesus responds with, this cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. Now, in some versions, it says anything but prayer and fasting. And so, like in my Bible, it says but prayer in the text, and then it says but prayer and fasting in the footnote. So either the footnote is right or the text is right. I don't really know. Like, I've read a lot about it this week, and I don't know which is right. But actually, like, if we go with fasting, that's not going to be a bad thing either, all right? So, like, whichever way you want to read that, that's I don't think, a problem. But the thing is, you know if he just says, this thing cannot be driven out by anything but prayer, Now, surely you think, well, the disciples would have thought of that, you know? Jesus ministry 101, prayer, you know? We come to him with the requests that we have. But the thing is, the word that Jesus is using here for prayer is so much richer than just run up to Jesus, like bombard him with a load of requests and run away. The word here literally means a wish exchange. This is a relational, intimate, heart-to-heart where we come to God and we bring our wishes to him and we allow him, no, we invite him to shape our wishes, dreams, hopes, desires according to his heart. We exchange our wishes for his. And you know, the more that we walk in that kind of in that kind of intimacy and friendship with him, then it means that we see more of what he's doing. And because we see more of what he's doing, so we are able to have more faith. And we're able to place more faith in him because we see who he is and we see what he's doing. And we've got to remember where the disciples were at this point. Because you know the fact that Jesus says, "O faithless generation," it implies that the disciples don't have that kind of faith in this moment. And remember where the disciples are at in their journey. Just next week, you know, you can read a few verses down. Depending on your version, you might have a little paragraph that says, "Who is the greatest?" So Jesus next week, not next week because he's already done this, but next week in our little journey, is going to predict his death again. And straight away after he predicts his death, the disciples have this argument about who is greatest in the kingdom. Which of them is the greatest? Now, do you really think that they're getting this? The disciples are a little bit clueless as to what's going on here. And so it's almost like the boss has gone away up the mountain, or the teacher has left the classroom, and the kids have decided, we know what's going on here, you know? Oh, you have a child that needs attention. Well, watch and learn, earthlings, we've got this. But the thing is, they've missed the point. There's almost like an arrogance that has crept in. They've gone from a place of desperate, delighted dependence on Jesus and on the name of Jesus in that first mission, and they've now gone to this place of, we know what we're doing. This is almost like ministry by playbook, you know? An algorithm, a flow chart. Well, as long as I follow the right steps, I'm just going to do exactly what I did before. But the thing is, it doesn't work like that. And church, I'll be honest, you know, for me, in the last kind of 12 years that I've been privileged to be part of leading this, I have fell into, at points, the playbook. Oh, I've seen this situation before. I know what's going on here. Utterly humiliated by being clueless in those circumstances because I haven't asked, Lord, what are you doing here? What are you doing in this situation? Because that's the kind of intimacy that we need to develop. Because the thing is, faith flows from friendship. Now, I've got a friend, and that friend, some of you know that friend. I'm not going to name him because I don't want to embarrass him. Andy. And many of you have experienced, so have I, just the fact that this man walks in friendship with God and he listens. That's all he does. Just listens. And there are these moments when he's like, do you know, I really believe that the Lord is doing something there in that person's life. Oh, there's a sick person. Like, I remember one day there was somebody who we announced at the front was sick and couldn't make it to church and was stuck in their garden in the pouring down rain with a bad back. He was like, I need to go and pray for them. I believe that God's doing something. Went up there, prayed for them, they got healed. And that's the kind of faith that flows from friendship. It hooks into the activity of heaven. Now, equally, you know where the Lord isn't working? Then, like, I asked him, like, I had, you know, my wonky left side. Those of you that have been around a long time, you'll know about my wonky left side. When I asked him to pray for my wonky left side, and he prayed for me, and absolutely nothing happened. Nothing. And I said, he said to me, anything? And I said, no. And he said, well, I got to be honest with you. I wasn't really feeling it. I didn't really feel like the Lord was going to do anything at that point. But you know, I prayed to you, and it was kind of like paracetamol, you know? It didn't actually deal with the root cause, but it made me feel better, and I felt so encouraged. But the thing is, it's such a joy, and we've got people in this church who pray, and they pray faithfully, and like, I can throw them a situation which I can't give them any details about. And I say, I've got one of those situations again. And they say, you don't need to give us details. And then they come back at me, and they say, oh, you know, I was praying about it, and I feel like the Lord has been showing me this about the situation. I'm like, have you you been listening to my phone calls? Like, have you tapped my conversations? Because it feels like they know what's going on, because their faith is being exercised from a friendship with God. That's the kind of relationship that we want to walk in. And that's what Jesus is kind of directing the disciples towards here. You've been leaning on your own intuition. You've been leaning on your own wisdom here. Press into the wish exchange. Come and know the heart of the Father. And actually, where there are circumstances like this little boy, which is really desperate, really dire, how much more do we need to press in delighted dependence on the Father, listening to what he's saying? How much more do we need to fast, to park our physical hungers, to say, Lord, I am more hungry to hear what you have to say than I am hungry for what I want to eat. So that's what he calls us to. And you know, this is why we've been like banging on and on and on and on about growing as a church in prayer. It's not so that we get a reputation. We can, you know, get the prayer quality mark out the front there. You know, we are the most praying church in Merthyr or whatever. This is so that we grow in that intimacy and dependence on the Father, so that where the Father is doing something, we just hook our tiny sliver of faith into that and we get on board with what he's doing. We need to be these kind of praying people. And again, not as a means to an end. He is the means to the end. But then he involves us in what he's doing. And what a joy that is. You see, the thing is, if we allow distance to creep in, with distance comes doubt. And we don't want that kind of distance. So then Jesus asks the disciples to bring the little boy to him. And he says, bring him to me. And in verse 20, we've got a pretty unique occurrence when Jesus encounters a demonic spirit. It says, and then they brought the boy to him. And when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. Now, normally, when Jesus encounters demonic spirits, the demons have got one up on us when it comes to recognizing Jesus. You look at most of the accounts through the Gospels. People see an afflicted person, and they see Jesus, and they just see a bloke. And they see a bloke who can teach and do some pretty special things. But the demons clap eyes on Jesus and they cry out, what have you to do with us, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? They recognize who he is. And they know that they are powerless in the face of who he is. And yet this demon, it feels like he kind of ramps it up a little bit. He's a mute demon, so he isn't allowing the little boy to speak anyway. And he kind of, he does this show of force and starts throwing the little boy around. It's almost like, you know, I'm going to show you, Jesus. I'm going to show you. And do you know what Jesus does at this point when he encounters this doubting dad? And I love this. Jesus doesn't go straight to action. Deliverance and healing for Jesus are not like a work project that he just needs to crack on with. Jesus says to the Father, how long has this been happening to him? Over and over and over again in the ministry of Jesus, you see Jesus coming to people and saying, I see you. I see you. And I want you to know that you are seen. And he says to the Father, how long has this been happening to him? And you know, the Father then describes what's been going on with this child. And I think it's really important for us to see here that Mark isn't just some kind of pre-technological Luddite who actually, this little boy's just got a neurological disorder. That's all he's got. And so what Jesus is doing here is healing. And the gospel writers didn't really know what they were talking about. You know, in Matthew's gospel, Matthew says that Jesus healed people who had seizures and he delivered people from demonic powers. In the same sentence, they knew the difference. This isn't sickness. This is darkness that's going on here. And he says, this has been going on from childhood. And you know, this makes me really uncomfortable because like this little boy gives no explanation as to why this little boy is afflicted. This innocent child, it just feels so unfair, so unjust that this spirit has a power over him and casts him into fire and to water to destroy him. The fire and the water being symbols of judgment and chaos and destruction. Because that's what the demonic is all about. Wherever the demonic is at work, it will always be to steal and kill and destroy. And you can imagine that for this father, over time, how his faith has been crushed and ground down by his circumstances. And he comes to Jesus. And I don't know whether you would call it hopeful doubt or doubtful hope. But there's a sliver of something where he says to Jesus, if you can, have compassion and help us. And you know, this is different to the leper that came to Jesus in chapter 1, who was pretty much convinced that Jesus could. He just didn't know whether Jesus wanted to. And so he said to him, if you will, you can make me clean. But this father's got a different question. The question for this father is, I believe that you want to because you have compassion. I see your heart. But can you? And our doubts often hover. Like if we identify with this doubtful dad, our doubts often hover around either the question of can God or will God. And then sometimes we're convinced that he can and that he will, but then he doesn't in the moment, and we question his wisdom in his timing. But Jesus responds to this father and he says, if you can, all things are possible for the one who believes. Now, I feel like I need to say this because there are all kinds of wrong that we could go with this statement. All things are possible for the one who believes. And this is all from personal experience, what I'm about to say to you, okay? This is not just made up. I have walked with people who have believed that what Jesus was saying here is, if I just believe hard enough, then I'll get what I want. Now, this kind of belief, this health, wealth, prosperity stuff, never was a part of the good news until like the middle of the last century. You know, for obvious reasons, you think about how the wealth of the world has increased and that kind of stuff has become the thing that we desire and the thing that we aspire to. You know, never before in church history was health, wealth, prosperity part of the gospel. Never. And yet, there are now people who think, you know, if I just believe hard enough, you know, if I believe hard enough, then I'll get what I want. But then it gets taken a step further. As long as I declare it with enough power, you know, I'm going to declare to God what he needs to do. Because it says here, all things are possible for the one who believes. I believe, so I'm going to declare it. You know, and you see people, like I've been with people who have declared a healing in their body. And they've said, you know, I'm not going to doubt this. Like, the physical evidence tells me that I haven't been healed, but I'm going to declare my healing anyway. And I'm going to live with the cognitive dissonance of my body saying one thing and my faith saying another. Because I can't possibly acknowledge that this hasn't happened. Because otherwise, I'm not believing hard enough. And if I don't believe hard enough, then God won't do it. And so I'm going to declare it. I'm going to keep on declaring. And then it goes up a notch. And I think this is possibly the one that is most harmful. When you pray, you know, you've just got to tell God what to do. And you don't say, if you will it. Because, you know, you just got to tell him what to do. Do you know, all of that is just a kind of Jesus-sized version of New Age spirituality. The law of manifestation, the law of attraction. If I send out enough positive vibes into the universe, then the universe owes me some favor and it's going to give me everything I want. I'm going to attract that favor back. Just swapping the word universe for God. It's godless. And that's not what Jesus is talking about here. Do you know, Jesus is the source and the focus of faith. And when we recognize who he is and we give him our allegiance, we recognize that he's king. We place faith in him. Our faith is anchored in him. Our faith comes as a gift from him in the first place. And so then our requests begin to line up with his character and are in submission to his superior wisdom and will. And you know, even Jesus, there's only one other place in Mark's gospel where this phrase, all things are possible, is used. And it's when Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's about to be betrayed. And he says, all things are possible for you, Father. You can take this cup of suffering away from me. Yet, not my will, but yours be done. Jesus, in his humanity, submits to the will of the Father. That's the model for us. But the question then is, if all things are possible for the one who gives faith to Jesus, then how much faith do we need to give? I think this is one of the biggest gifts that Mark gives us in his gospel. I believe, help my unbelief. I believe. I have a sliver and a fragment of faith, and I am placing that faith in you. But it is lacking so much. And so, Lord, would you fill up what I lack? I believe. Help my unbelief. You know, clearly, faith matters because it is by faith that we engage with the activity of heaven. And yet, even then, he does the heavy lifting because faith itself is a gift. Paul says, for it is by grace you've been saved through faith, And this, not from yourselves, it's a gift of God, not by works, so that no one will boast. Even faith is a gift. We don't even do the work of faithing. Mel would be upset with me for turning faith into a verb there. Thankfully, she's not here this morning. But even we don't get the glory for placing our faith in him. Jesus does not require perfect and unmixed faith. And isn't that just as well? Okay, quick consumer survey here. How many of you have perfect faith today? Right, there we go. Okay, so this is good news for us all, isn't it? He said, if you have faith as big as a mustard seed, Jesus loves to hook into even the tiniest sliver, the tiniest fragment of faith, so that we get to participate in what he's doing. Lord, I give you what faith I have. Help my unbelief. And you know, if you want to know a prayer that is guaranteed an answer, here's the top 7 prayers in the Bible that are guaranteed an answer. I mean, I'm kind of joking a little bit, but the fact is that this is true. If you come to him with this prayer, he will never turn you away. If you say, Lord, I have these doubts, I have these questions, I have this tiny, tiny, tiny little fragment of faith, fill me up, give me more faith, he will answer that prayer. And do you know what? It may be that he gives you faith for the circumstances that you're in to actually, like, do and participate in what he's doing in that moment. And it might be that he gives you faith to endure in those circumstances, to trust who he is and who he continues to be in those circumstances. He loves to answer this prayer. You got this prayer, you pray it, he's going to answer. But then, back to the story. There's a crowd coming. There's this the scribes and the disciples have been arguing and this family, but now there's a hubbub, and a hubbub draws a crowd, doesn't it? And this crowd comes running, and I love what Jesus does in this moment. I love the dignity that he gives to this little boy. He doesn't turn his deliverance into a sideshow or a circus, but instead, before the crowd can come, Jesus acts. He did it with the blind man a few weeks back, didn't he? When Steve was preaching to us, he took the blind man aside. I love Jesus. I love the dignity that he gives to people. And Jesus rebukes this demon, and he says, you mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. Go and don't come back. So how does the demon respond to this? Now again, this is unusual. This is an unusual kind of occurrence between Jesus and a demon. After crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out. I remember a number of years back, I was teaching in my lab, and my lesson was very quiet and very peaceful, and then I heard a lot of commotion from the lab next door, and then I heard my colleague shouting, help, help! And so I ran through the prep room into the lab next door and was confronted by tables flying everywhere and chairs, and there were these two kids who were like proper going at it at the front of the class, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to take authority in this room. So I walked in and went, stop! Well, they did. And I was like, oh, that's good, you know, because, you know, if they didn't, it would have been slightly humiliating. But they did, and they just kind of looked at me. And then the scrawnier of the two came up to me. He went, come on then, odd man, what are you going to do about it? And the thing is, he was like 4 foot and a spit. And I was 6'3" and probably about 16 stone at that point. And I couldn't help it. I just laughed. I just laughed in his face, and I went, just go. Just go. And what do you know? He did. But not before kicking a few more chairs over, pushing another kid, slamming the door on the way out. And what you got going on here, and I'm not comparing myself to Jesus in this circumstance by any stretch of the imagination, but what you've got going on here is that the demon knows that it's got to respond to Jesus. It has to do what Jesus tells it. But not before causing more kerfuffle, because the demonic are narcissistic attention seekers who are only out to destroy. That's all they do. And the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, he is dead. Now what does this situation look like for Jesus? This looks like defeat. This looks like Jesus has, like, his intention to bring life to this boy and to bring him freedom has been completely undercut. Seems like the boy is dead, but Jesus took him by the hand and he lifted him up and he arose. And that word, he arose, is the same word that Jesus uses over and over again in Mark's gospel to describe what he's going to do after the third day. we are meant to see in this story a resurrection. Can you imagine how the Father is feeling at this point? Can you imagine where the Father's faith is at this point? You know, as William Lane says, the dethroning of Satan is always a reversal of death and an affirmation of life. But you know, we need to remember where we are in the story, because remember that where we're at, Mark's Gospel, I'm coming into land now, three chunks. You've got Jesus displaying what his kingdom looks like. We've now got Jesus en route from Galilee to Jerusalem, and he's telling his disciples what it means for him to be king in a really surprising way. He's predicted to them that for him to be Messiah, it means that he's got to be rejected. He's got to suffer. He's got to be killed. And he's got to rise again. And that is how he takes the throne of the glory that he displayed on the Mount of Transfiguration. He's going to tell them twice more that he's got to die. And so it just seems like a really odd place for this story to happen. Why is this happening here at this point? We know if we sum up what we've just seen in this story, we see an innocent son, a son who doesn't open his mouth. The forces of evil ranged against this little boy, the disciples who are powerless. The son is left for dead. We have an appearance of defeat, and then the son arose. Do you see what's going on here? Do you see what's going on? This is a living parable of what Jesus is about to accomplish. And from our perspective, what Jesus already has accomplished. And you know, because he has, this is why we can trust him. This is why we can come to him and say, I place my faith such as it is in you. I believe. Help my unbelief. We have an innocent son who was silenced before his accusers, who takes all of the evil and the sin and the muck of the world into himself. He appears defeated, but then he rises from the dead. And you know, his victory is certain. We're not walking in the fullness of that victory yet, but we're seeing glimpses of that victory now. He purchases eternal life, united to him forever, to all who give faith to him. You place your faith in him. You anchor your faith in him. He can be trusted. He can be trusted with your life now and for eternity. And you know, as we respond this morning, I want to ask a question. Which kind of doubter do you identify with here? You know, if your doubt is like the scribes, I've got to say, that's a dangerous place to be. Because when we're in that place, our hearts just get harder to the point where nothing will convince us. But you know, if you're in a place of questioning and you've got questions to ask, like I said, please ask your questions, because Jesus is bigger than your questions. And there are answers. If you feel more like the disciples where distance has crept in and you found yourself kind of relying on the playbook of faith, you know, well, I've been living this out for years and so I don't really need to pray anymore. And you find yourself just getting cold and faithless in different circumstances. I want to encourage you this morning, come back. Come back to him. And the wonder of God is that, you know, when you walk away from God, even if it's non-intentional, even if you just kind of, you stop moving forward with him and you find yourself having that distance, you know, as soon as you turn around, do you know where he is? Right there. Because he's always pursuing. He's always coming after. And as soon as you turn, he's there. And so come back to him. Come to delight yourself once more on what he has to say to you. To have your inner person shaped and molded and changed by who he is. And let your faith then grow through friendship. But you know, this morning, if you feel like the dad and you've been ground into doubt through your circumstances, there is a prayer to pray that he delights to answer. And he stands ready to bolster your faith today. And I know this not because he's told me this morning in a special word that I want to fill up the faith of people who are feeling faithless this morning. I want to shore up the people who are doubting. He said it in his word time and time and time again. This is who he is and this is what he does. And so I want to encourage us this morning. You know those circumstances that come to mind for you? the circumstances that cause you to doubt who he is and what he's about. I want to encourage you that while we're singing, and we're singing songs that direct our attention towards who he is, there's a little table over there with cards on. I want you to write down, go over there and just write down, what are those things that are causing you that kind of grinding doubt? Sometimes it helps just to see it written down. And then bring it and put it in the little basket that's under this table, because this table reminds us of his commitment to us. This table reminds us of who he is for us, who he is with us, who he is in us. And so bring those things to him. And you know, as you place it in there, say to him, and say it out loud, I believe, help my unbelief. Pray that prayer. And then later this morning, we're also going to take time to minister to one another. In those situations where there is doubt, where there is darkness, where there are sick bodies, and we're going to invite the Holy Spirit to come. We're going to ask him, Lord, what are you doing here? And let our faith flow from a place of friendship. And may he this morning dispel the doubt and darkness that dogs our lives and grow our faith. May he increase our certainty, not in our circumstances, but in him and in his permanent witness in our circumstances. Shall we pray?